Abel Oladamare Jinyami Olarun God Jehovah Allah Amen Ra, the many names for the original ancestor, the ancestor who sees all and knows all, the creator of the heavens and the earth. We do not pour libation to you, but this morning we come pouring libation in memory and honor of our ancestors and asking them to intercede with you on our behalf. We know that our ancestors, being in the spirit world, are closer to you, and there's a greater opportunity that our request will be granted. We ask this morning that you grant the listeners the willingness to open their hearts and their minds to the information that's going to be shared, such that they will hear the truth and then be able to act on the truth. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To our ancestors from Mother Africa, the ancestors who were the beginning of the human family that we now have, no matter what your ethnic or cultural background is, the beginning of human life as we know it was on the African continent. Every person on the face of the earth has as their original ancestor an African. We ask those Africans who were the first to conceive of a family, the first to plant a seed, the first to till the land, the first to domesticate animals, the first to navigate the mighty Nile River to Egypt, the first to build a skyscraper, the first to do surgeries, the first to explore the wonders of the galaxy, and as importantly, the first to conceive of the belief in one God. We ask those ancestors to come and be with us today, to bring their wisdom, their hard work, their ingenuity to all that we do. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To our ancestors who were murdered, displaced, diminished during our great Holocaust, our great Miafa, we do not forget you. We remember your unwilling sacrifice as your bodies are lined the Sahara and the Atlantic Ocean. We remember you and we honor you and we ask that you come and be with us today. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. We ask our ancestors who gave us the great document, the Ma'at, to come be with us, bring your additional sense of honor and integrity as embodied by Ma'at to our discussions and our listings this morning. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To those ancestors from the Caribbean islands, from Brazil, from the southern parts of these United States, who through your unpaid labor laid the groundwork for the civilizations that are enjoyed by billions of people around the world. To those ancestors, we say we do not forget you. We remember your sacrifice, your hard work. And we ask that you come and be with us today to inspire us to also do the work required to correct a world that has gone mad. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. And to those ancestors who are yet to be born, those ancestors for whom we do good work, those ancestors to whom we pledge to honorably do righteous work all the time for ourselves, for our families, for our communities, so we can be correct to be able to benefit from the largesse that the Creator has provided for all of us. Ancestors, we pledge ourselves to continue to do work such that when you return, this place will be a better earth. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. And finally, we'd like to ask you and our audience to think of one of your ancestors, someone who you would like to be with us this morning. On the count of three, ask that ancestor to come and be with us. One, two, three. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We said libation, libation, libation. It is good.
People use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
I think what you're trying to ask is, why am I so insistent upon giving out to them that blackness, that black power, that black pushing them to identify with black culture. I think that's what you're asking. If I have no choice over it in the first place, to me, we are the most beautiful creatures in the whole world, black people. I mean, and I mean that in every sense, outside and inside. And to me, we have a culture that is surpassed by no other civilization, but we don't know anything about it. So, again, I think I've said this before in this same interview, I think, at some time before, my job is to somehow make them curious enough or persuade them by hook or crook to get more aware of themselves and where they came from and what they are into and what is already there, and just to bring it out. This is what compels me to compel.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. And I mean every word of it. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. This is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet. Hound dogs on my trail. School children sitting in jail. Black cat cross my path. I think every day is gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you. People just about do. I've been there, so I know. Keep on saying, go slow. Well, that's just the trouble. Washing the windows. Picking the cotton. You're just plain rotten.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Welcome again to another edition of the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. This afternoon, this evening, we have a very powerful discussion. Our topic centers on the idea is either you lead, you follow, or you get the hell out of the way. We're talking about black leadership. We're going to focus on a couple of events in our historical journey and sort of mold from that the idea of what this leadership needs to be and how we need to understand that as fighters and warriors out here in this battle that we are waging each and every day. Two wonderful guests and some others that have joined us. I am really excited about that. I have with here who are no stranger to the Black Reality Think Tank. He's been with us many times before. His name is Brother Marvin X, and Brother Marvin is a beautiful and dynamic brother who was a part of the Black Arts Movement. Who was there on the battlefield in Oakland during the time that the Panthers were waging their war. He crisscrossed across the country to New York, worked on the Black Arts, and just so many other wonderful things he's done. We had a dynamic conversation several months back looking at the work of the great John Singleton and as he developed his programs and ideas around black males. And that was a dynamic program. As you know, we can go into our archives and listen to any of our programs that have aired, and I'll tell you how to access that. But also, Brother Marvin is a part of the recurring playing program here on the Time for an Awakening, and a lot of times his program just airs when there are no other programs on at the time. So I'm so happy to have him, and we also have another powerful brother who's no stranger. In fact, he was with me last week. Wonderful brother, Dr. Bruce Bridges. Dr. Bridges is a historian. He is a geographer. And he's also currently now teaching in a seminary in North Carolina. And he was the owner of one of the most dynamic bookstores in this country. It was called the No Books, and very dynamic. And as a matter of fact, I don't know, he does know Brother Marvin from his books and purchasing his books in his bookstore. So anyway, we're going to talk about all that, and then we have another brother. I'm not quite sure if he wants me to mention his name, but we can do that if so later. He's calling out of San Francisco, and we'll be able to talk to him. And then some of our other community panel that are here with us, Brother Timothy out of Philadelphia, representing part of the Nation of Islam, and they're going to be talking about some leadership issues as well. So we appreciate you, all of you, for joining us. The Black Reality Think Tank is on the platform of timeforanawakening.com, which operates out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is also a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. And I have said many times before, the Black Talk Radio Network is the number one black podcast in the world, internationally, because, as you know, podcast is internet, and that's international in format, and that has been rated by an independent body as the number one podcast in the world. So I'm so honored to be a part of this. The Black Reality Think Tank has three other family members that also produce programs on this network, as well as some other things. And so at the top of the hour, I'll talk about those. But right now, I want to get into this dynamic conversation and look at the whole idea of leadership. This idea sort of motivated us, you know, as we notice in the death of many of those icons of the civil rights movement, John Lewis, B.T. Vivian, and others who have now transitioned. And as I said last week and as we talked about, we wonder how they'll be written in history. How will they be presented? How will our great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren know of the work that they have done? Or will they just paint some illusory picture, which they normally do when write history? Unfortunately, our history is still written by those outside of our culture. And as a result of that, you don't always get the full image. So I'm hoping that some of the things that we are doing here at the Black Reality Think Tank will serve as an archival system so that people can go back in and listen from people, not only just those who were observing, but those who were on the battlefield. Brother, as I said, my brother Marvin was a part of the organizing committee of the Black Panther Party out of Oakland. And so he can tell you, you know, firsthand what the deal is about. That's what we call in history writing primary source. And that's what we want to be able to do. So we're going to be talking with them in just a minute. As always, we like to do an ancestral profile. And I thought maybe it would be appropriate for us this evening to focus on an ancestral profile that sort of speaks to what we are doing, which is the leadership. And so today I want to talk about a very dynamic, powerful sister who a lot of her work focused on developing leadership within the movement of the 60s, and her name was Ella Baker. Through her decades of work with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and later with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, better known as SNCC, Ella Baker emerged as one of the most important women in the civil rights movement. Ella Baker was born on December the 13th, 1903, in Norfolk, Virginia. After grammar school, her mother enrolled her in Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina. She graduated as the valedictorian of both her high school and college graduating classes. The college valedictorian honor was all the more remarkable because she worked her way through school as a waitress and a chemistry lab assistant. Ella Baker graduated from Shaw University with a BA degree in June of 1927. After graduation, Ms. Baker moved to New York City, where she became a waitress and community organizer involved in the radical politics. Later that year, 1927, she became a journalist for the American West Indian News. By 1930, she was named office manager of the Negro National News. In 1930, Ella Baker and George Shuler, who was the co-founder of the Young Negroes Cooperative League, the YNCL, as it's called, she was the organization's first secretary treasurer and chairman of the New York Council. In 1931, Ella Baker became the YNCL's national director. Shuler, the organization's president, then recommended her to the NAACP. In 1941, Ella Baker became an assistant field secretary of the NAACP. She also took the post of advisor for the New York City Youth Council of the NAACP. By the late 1940s, Ella Baker, a field secretary, was the NAACP's most effective organizer as she traveled the South charting new branches. In 1956, she organized in Friendship a group that raised money for the Montgomery bus boycott. Ella Baker was well known to criticize the sort of over-professionalized, charismatic leadership. She didn't like that. She promoted grassroots organizing, radical democracy, and the ability of the oppressed to understand their worlds and advocate for themselves. She realized that this vision most fully in the 1960s as she became the primary advisor and strategist of the SNCC movement. Ella Baker has been called one of the most important American leaders of the 20th century and perhaps the most influential woman in the civil rights movement. She is known for her critiques, as I said, not only of racism within American culture, but also because of sexism within the civil rights movement. In the 1960s, the idea of participatory democracy became popular among political activists, including those in the civil rights movement. It combined the traditional appeal of democracy with an innovative tie to broader grassroots participations. The new movement had three primary emphases. One, it was an appeal for grassroots involvement of people throughout society while making their own decision. Next, number two, it was the minimization of bureaucratic hierarchy-type leadership. That was opposed. They didn't want that kind of system. And the associated emphasis on expertise and professionalism as a basis for leadership. Rather, number three, she was in for a call for direct action as an answer to fear, isolation, and intellectual detachments. In other words, they did not want to be reactive. They wanted to be proactive. Ella Baker said one time, she said, "You don't see me on television. You don't see news stories about me. The kind of role that I tried to play was to pick up pieces or put them together out of which I hoped organizations might build. My theory is strong people don't need strong leaders." And according to the activist Mumia Abdul-Jamal, he said that Ella Baker advocated a more collectivist model of leadership over the prevailing messianic style of the period. Baker was largely arguing against the civil rights movement being structured along the organization's model of the black church. She thought that was wrong. It was not the way to get to the grassroots people. The black church then had largely female membership, but male leadership. Ella Baker questioned not only the gendered hierarchy of the civil rights movement, but also that of the black church. And I think one of the incidents that was definitely significant was the idea when it came to the March on Washington, and no women, as we talked about last week, were allowed to speak, and that became a major issue. Ella Baker and Martin Luther King and other CLC members were reported to have a lot of differences, and there were conflicts in their opinion and the philosophy during the 1950s and the 60s. She was older than many of those young ministers she worked with, which added to their tensions. She once said that the movement made Martin and not Martin the movement. When she gave a speech urging activists to take control of the movement themselves rather than rely on a leader with heavy feet of clay, it was widely interpreted as a denunciation of Dr. King. Ella Baker's philosophy was power to the people. If members worked together, she believed that a group's force could make significant change. As Baker, as I said earlier, she criticized very heavily a lot of the hierarchy system of things, but she was a consistent tone in the ear of Kwame Ture and a lot of those other young marchers of that time. She consistently urged them to take certain roles, and she was constantly there as an advisor. So in 1967, Ella Baker returned to New York City, where she continued her activism. She later collaborated with Arthur Kinoy and others to form what was called the Mass Party Organizing Committee, which is basically a socialist organization. In 1972, she traveled the country in support of the Free Angela campaign, demanding the release of activist and writer Angela Davis, who had been arrested in California as a communist. Davis was acquitted after representing herself in court. Ella Baker also supported the Puerto Rican independence movement and spoke out against apartheid in South Africa. She allied with a number. I just want to ask our audience, if you could please silence your mic. We are getting some background distraction. Thank you. She allied with a number of women's groups, including the Third World Women Alliance and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She remained an activist until her death in 1986 on her 83rd birthday. Ella Baker was a very private person. Many people close to her did not know that she was married for 20 years to T.J. Bob Roberts. Baker kept her own surname. She left no diaries. In recognition of her work, she was awarded a doctorate of letters from the City College of New York in May of 1985. Ella Baker died on her birthday, December 13, 1986, at the age of 83. My kind of woman. And that is very clearly what we want to talk about tonight, is the leadership of this nation. And looking at what has taken place, we want to talk a little bit, just a little bit, about the convention, the National Black Political Party Convention in Gary, Indiana, 1970, as people like Amira Baraka and others, Jesse Jackson and others, came together to try to organize the political machine. And we've got someone here with us, Brother Marvin X, who very clearly worked with Baraka during his years, as well as Dr. Bridges, who also has had some work with that group as well. So with that, we're going to introduce my dear brother, Marvin X. I appreciate you so much for coming to this my call. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank again, Brother Robin.
Thank you, Brother thank William you. Rogers, and thank you all the thank guests you. On your program tonight. And I'm, as Sly Stone said, I'm thankful and thoughtful to be here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I'm going to open up also. I'm going to welcome my brother that was here with me last week as we talked about the Civil Rights Movement. He is a very good friend, wonderful brother. He's my homeboy, too. Dr. Bruce Bridges from Durham, North Carolina. Welcome, Dr. Bridges. How you doing?
Hochep, my brother. Thank you very much for the welcome. And Hochep to my dear brother, Marvin X, I've heard of many years ago. And I get a chance to hear him tonight and his interesting history. So Hochep to you and your listeners. And hope we'll have a good discussion tonight.
Thank you so much. All right, let's get right on into it. Brother Marvin, did you ever encounter or work with Sister Baker during those years that you were in Oakland?
No, sir, I did not. But I'm familiar with her. There's an organization in her name still here in Oakland, the Ella Baker Center.
Oh, wow.
And I'm familiar with some of the work that they're doing. I think Van Jones was the leader of the Oakland Ella Baker Center for a time.
Okay.
He may still be associated with it.
Right. Well, I very clearly like her style of leadership. Would you like to just kind of comment on that approach she had? What do you think?
I like many of the things that she had to say about leadership, especially in respect to the church model of leadership.
Yes.
You know, because I had a daughter that was an official in one of those mega churches in Houston, Texas. And so I know what she encountered as a woman. And even though she was in a leadership position, she was often not recognized for her full talent.
Right.
So, and furthermore, you know, I have three daughters that I'm very, very proud of. And so I can only see them going beyond the sky. And I would not want them to be not allowed to reach their full potential.
Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, one of my daughters left America and is now a resident of Accra, Ghana, because she felt that she reached the glass ceiling here in America as a black woman. With all her talents, she said she went as far as she could go. So she's leading a movement in Accra, Ghana called Black Fit, which is to help return black people to Ghana or to the motherland.
I know you told me about that, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm all for, and most importantly, you know, I had a strong mother who raised 9 children and 2 grandchildren mainly by herself and operated her own real estate business. But she was a spiritual counselor as well, and she was a model for black business women. So my attitude is that women go as far as women can go, and sometimes they can fly higher than we can. But we can't prescribe them and keep them down any longer, especially when many of them are getting PhDs and MBAs and MAs and we're doing 35 to life. So how are you going to hold somebody down that got knowledge and you don't know nothing, but you think you got some power that you don't have, and you think you own something that you don't have, which is her body,
right,
for the most part. So we have to rethink this whole concept of what is a man, what is a woman, what is a leader, who can't be a leader, who can be a leader. My old concept basically is it grew out of what I recall from the Vietnam War. I don't know if I mentioned that in our last conversation, but if you recall that Vietnam War, when the Vietnamese went into Cambodia, I think it was Nixon who said, we're going to go into Cambodia to destroy the Central Command.
Right.
And he said that, and after he said that, soon after he said that, the Vietnamese Liberation Front came on the media, and they said, the Americans don't understand. They can't destroy the Central Command because we are all the Central Command.
That's right.
So that's my concept of what we need as leaders. Everybody got to be the leader. Everybody got to be the Central Command.
That's right. That's
and
right.
Step forward and do what you can do.
Gotcha. Thank you. Dr. Bridges, what do you think about the terms of leader? Like Ella Baker's philosophy was that strong people don't need strong leaders. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. I do agree with that. Strong people, they have leaders, which really makes it better for the whole group. If the people are strong and the leadership is strong, and especially if the people can stand if something happens to the leadership. Now, in many of the historic situations with leadership in the world, you'll find oftentimes once that leader or head is destroyed, then the whole movement falters or the whole movement fails or it's all finished.
Right.
So if there is strong leadership and the masses are strong, I think it makes it all for the better. Now, tied right into what Brother Marvin said about the Vietnamese people, he reminded me of something that another tremendous African leader said by the name of Thomas Sankara, who was the leader of Burkina Faso in West Africa, which was previously called Upper Volta by the French, but he took the name back into its African name and called it Burkina Faso. They asked him why his pictures were not all around in the country like most leaders do. They put their pictures up everywhere, in the airport, in the administrative buildings, in the mansions, and everywhere. The pictures are there. But he said, I don't do that because there are thousands of Sankaras. Once Sankara is gone, it does not mean the revolution has finished. because all the people are Sankaras. You see,
that's right.
So Brother Marvin made me think of that on another level, in terms of what he said with the Vietnamese. And I want to mention too that when you study the leadership of Thomas Sankara, and a lot of your listeners, I don't know, may or may not have heard of Thomas Sankara, but when you study the leadership of Thomas Sankara, you will find that he was a person who actually, can you still hear me? I hear a lot of it in the background. Am I still coming through clear?
Yeah, you still, okay? you are, yeah, just some folk have the mic through, but go right ahead. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, good. Yeah, so I was about to say that, so Sankara made that statement, and when you study leadership, which will tie right into Brother Marvin's background, I'm sure he'll agree with this, and I wanted to speak on it because it would help a lot of our youngsters who may be listening, or some of our oldsters who are listening and may pass something on to the youngsters, his association with the Black Panther Party. But Thomas Sankara, before he became the leadership, into leadership in Burkina Faso, he studied under one of his school teachers in a French school in Burkina Faso. As you know, the colonizer always sets up, as Bob Marley says in his song, The Babylon System, they always build university and church and university, which we've talked about tonight briefly, church leadership. They build church and university, deceiving the people continually. So in the French colony of Burkina Faso, when Sankara grew up, he was taught in a French school, and one of his black teachers in the French school decided one day to teach the class about imperialism and colonialism and neocolonialism and communism. So when Brother Marvin talked about the Vietnamese, he reminded me, Sankara, as he developed and grew in his leadership and became the president of Burkina Faso, had studied this in high school in his colonial country of Burkina Faso before he approached leadership. So when we study leadership in an individual, what's important is that we study what made this person become the he or the she that he or she became. Because none of us, you, me, Brother Marvin, and your listeners, anybody in the world, there's something that caused us to become what we became or what we are now. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, it's what we have fed on in terms of our knowledge. Going back to Brother Marvin again, we talked about brothers that got 35 to life and the sisters out here studying and getting knowledge and getting knowledge. And this knowledge is taken today.
Right.
And going back to the black women, the brothers today in the world have to take their hats off to the black women of today. Look at America. Look at Ilhan Omar. Look at Anastasia Cortez out of Brooklyn. Look at the Palestinian sister out of Michigan. Look at Lightfoot in Chicago. Look at Lance Bottoms in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Look at the D.C. mayor.
Good point.
You know, so the women are stepping forward today. So I'm tying into a lot of things, like I said, you know, what Brother Marvin said, the women, the church leadership, and that kind of thing. And I think it is actually criminal for any church system to say that they're not going to let a person, because of her gender, step into a leadership position if she is qualified to take the leadership. Let her take the leadership.
Right.
Elaine Brown took the leadership of the Black Panther Party when Huey was in exile.
Right.
That's right,
and I'm going.
On.
So
okay,
you know, all right.
Let me
get to.
All right, I'm gonna come back to you, but let me go to Mother Marvin, and we mentioned in the Black Panthers. Brother Marvin was one of the organizers of the original Black Panther Party out of Oakland.
Now let me get that straight now.
Okay, good. Go right ahead. Go right ahead.
I was an associate.
Okay.
All right. Let's say I was an associate.
You were still in it.
Brothers in the Black Panther Party. I never joined the Black Panther Party, but a lot of the brothers did come through my organization. We had a institution called the Black House in San Francisco.
Okay.
And it was co-founded with Eldridge Cleaver and myself, and this is before he even joined the Black Panther. It was just after he got released from prison, Soledad, 1966. And he came to San Francisco. And we set up a political cultural center called Black House. And it was a place where all the poets came that were in the area. Sonia Sanchez was there. Mary Baraka was there. The Chicago Art Ensemble. All kinds of people came through there. And then we had political workshops. Mm-hmm. And combined with the political workshops and the cultural presentations and the poetry and the drama, it drew a lot of people to the Black House. And it just so happened that, starting with Elvis Cleaver, who eventually went to the Black Panther Party at my instigation, but at the Black House also came Samuel Napier, who became the Minister of Distribution of the Black Panther paper. Mm-hmm. Also came through the Black House was Emory Douglas, who became the Minister of Culture, who is created all that artwork. There was George Murray, a poet, who became the Minister of Education. So a lot of people came through the Black Panther Party through me. You can say it like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Talk a little bit about the leadership structure then for me during those early years of the Black Panther Party in Oakland. What was that like? Since we are addressing leadership styles and obviously the impact it has on the work.
Well, I would say originally, as if you recall, there were three people that were the first members of the Black Panther Party: Bobby Seale, Huey Newton, and little Bobby Hutton. Those were the three. I think Bobby was the chairman. I guess Huey was the what?
Minister of Defense.
I don't know what the title was. But Bobby was the chairman. But Huey was the leader, and then little Bobby was the secretary. So those were the three leaders. But eventually, once they became under Marxism, I think they developed a kind of central committee leadership.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's probably how it ended up, as a central committee form of leadership.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Based on the Marxist or Chinese or communist model, whatever.
Right.
That's right.
And it was, I do recall that. I know there was a book written by a guy named Brisbane called Black Activism, and he discussed that model that was used and set up by the Panthers. Now, it was an excellent model from what I've heard in terms of critiques. Now, there's somebody else you work with. I want to ask you about him, the Black Think Tank. Brother, he and his wife. What was that about? What was that a little bit about?
Well, Dr. Nathan Hare is speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife, Dr. Julia Hare, who has joined the Ancestors. Of course, you know, Dr. Hare, before he came to San Francisco State to become chairman of the Black Studies Department, first Black Studies Department on a major college campus in America.
That's right.
He had been thrown out of Howard University.
Right.
Partly for bringing Muhammad Ali on campus to discuss the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the college put chains on the door of the auditorium where Muhammad Ali was supposed to speak. But it went by the grapevine. Back in those days, there wasn't no internet. I don't know, it was 5,000-6,000 people showed up outside the temple or chapel where Ali was supposed to speak. So, of course, the administration and the white people that ran Howard University and D.C., they got rid of Dr. Hare.
Right.
So he came out here and champion to establish Black Studies at San Francisco State.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, it led to one of the most violent and longest strikes in American academic history at San Francisco State to establish Black Studies. And eventually, after many students were beaten bloody and went to jail, went to prison, and Dr. Hare was ultimately removed, and he went into eventually went into private practice as a clinical psychologist. He got a second PhD, and one in sociology, and he went and got a second one. But basically, he was removed from academia for his leadership. You can say, if you want to say it like that.
Exactly. The I remembered his Black Think Tank concept, which I really had a strong appreciation for that. As a matter of fact, that even has to, I borrowed some of that when we started the Black Reality Think Tank a little bit, based on Dr. Hare's work. Dr. Bridges, what do you remember about that Black Studies setup? I know you've done a lot of work on that in terms of your research.
As usual, Dr. Rogers, is an excellent program because you really stimulate my mind, and then Brother Marvin makes me think about a lot of things. Because and I never miss you, Brother Marvin. Maybe at one point we'll get a chance to meet each other. But I'm over on the East Coast. You're on the West Coast. I'm on the East Coast. So we got.
In Durham?
I'm in Durham, my brother. What you know about Durham?
Well, I'm sorry. You know, I was at Duke University in February.
That's right. You sure were.
Black Muslim Atlantic Conference.
You know, I meant to tell Dr. Bridges that you were coming to Durham. I don't know why I slipped that.
Is that the conference where my brother named Fahim Knight stood up and challenged a lot of those Eastern Muslims about not being black enough and being more Arab?
It sounds like that might have been him, because I might have been sitting right next to him.
And I called him about tonight.
I challenged him also.
Oh, man, we need to talk. I don't want to take Brother Dr. Rogers' program tonight, but you and I have to, we got to talk again later on.
Well, we might can work that in before this is over with.
Okay. That's interesting. That's powerful.
It is. As a matter of fact, as I said before, a good program, Dr. Rogers, and he's making me think about a lot of things. But when you mentioned Nathan Hare, I met Nathan Hare, I guess, about 5 to 7 years ago at Rush College in Memphis, Tennessee. Right, Rush College. I met him there, and he was on the bus going back to the airport, and I was going back to the airport. There had been a conference on leadership at Rush College, and I met Nathan, and I was surprised when Marvin said that his wife, who has done a tremendous amount of work, Julia, has gone to the ancestors because she was living. She must have just passed. So I just wanted to mention that. And also he said something else that I wanted to speak on, and that is Black Studies, as you asked me to mention. In Raleigh, North Carolina, when I was teaching Black Studies, and the first person to ever teach Black Studies at North Carolina State University, too, Bill, I don't know if you know that or not, but I was removed, not at that time, but later on, when you become, Dr. Hare taught sociology, and he taught Black Studies and psychology, but at the same time, he was an activist. And this is a situation, it was back then, people were not just in the classroom teaching or talking, but they were also in the street as activists.
Right.
I had several of my students when I was teaching at NC State. We went downtown in Raleigh, formed an organization, and made signs up protesting apartheid in South Africa. I did the same thing in 1987, 1988. Led a group of people who marched on the graduation ceremony at North Carolina Central University with signs, U.S., come out of South Africa, divestment programs, and that kind of thing.
So
scholars at that time were not just scholars. Scholars would take that information that they were receiving and reading and studying and researching and put it to work. That's what Huey did. Huey, when you study his history as a leader, Huey was from Louisiana and went to school at a small community college. If my memory is serving me right, Brother Marvin, you correct me.
Merritt College.
I was about to say he went to Merritt College.
We went there together. Me, him, and Bobby Seale.
There you go. It's coming out now, see? He went to Merritt College, and he studied Black Studies, and then they began to question what was going on in the university.
Wait a minute now. There was no Black Studies in 1962.
That's right.
We studied independently, what they call now, peer group sessions. So we had, and these were outside of the college, not as a part of the college. We studied in cafes and each other's rooms, but we were studying, trying to get, Bobby Seale, in an interview I did with him, he called us the neo-black intellectuals. We were about discovering our consciousness.
Right.
African consciousness. And I can just tell you, give you a short list of some of the books we were reading and discussing. Wretched of the Earth, Franz Fanon, Kwame Nkrumah's writings, Neocolonialism, Final Stage of Imperialism, Black Bourgeoisie by Dr. E. Franklin Frazier.
Right. That's the classics.
Patrice Lumumba's writings, Nelson Mandela's writings of what was going on in South Africa with Sharpeville and all that. We studied Fidel Castro and Mao Zedong and Ho Chi Minh.
Right.
And you know what, we studied independence of the college.
It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy that we've got to say that this was coming out of those European universities. And a lot of our black colleges were not doing any of that. They were not encouraging that kind of learning. Dr. Bridges, you and I both know at our alma mater, Donkana Central, it was individuals.
Oh, no. Oh, bourgeois education there, right.
You mentioned, brother, about Burkina Faso and the colonial education that the brother, what was the brother's name?
Thomas Sankara.
Thomas Sankara that he received. And this is really what we're really talking about here, because this education.
Right.
This is the same thing we're getting now. Education. And as far as I'm concerned, for the most part, black studies morphed into a colonial or neo-colonial education.
Right.
Exactly.
Let me make a point with this. In 72, I was invited to teach at UC Berkeley, along with Sun Ra and some other, as you just said, radical activists. And shortly, the entire faculty was removed by the chancellor. The entire faculty of black studies, all the radical brothers and sisters were removed.
Then
and then they brought in some the colonial elite.
Doesn't surprise me.
I don't want to say no names.
Yep.
Right.
So that might take us further into debate. But some of them were sincere, but a lot of them were colonial elite because they went along with the program.
Exactly. And you know, Bill, Brother Marvin is making me think about just a whole lot of stuff. And he just mentioned, too, about Franz Fanon is one of the people they used to read. And reading about Thomas Sankara, he was saying that was one author that he studied tremendously because Fanon, first of all, was a psychiatrist, but also Fanon was from Martinique and lived in Algeria, which was colonized by the French.
And part of the colonialist idea.
And see, and when we talk about education, too, you see, we got to look at the fact, too, that Sankara and Huey and Marvin X and Bobby and Maurice Bishop in Grenada was colonized by the British, but in his education in Grenada, Roman Catholic education, but he took that and went outside of what he was learning in the classroom when he went to England to get his law degree and began to, he heard about a group called the Black Panthers. He heard about a bad brother out in California named Huey P. Newton who was standing up to white folk with guns. And he then took that education along with the colonial education, took the outside education, went back to Grenada, took over the country of Grenada, and became the prime minister. And interestingly enough, since we're talking about leadership, Maurice Bishop, born in 1944, died in 1983, and Sankara, born in 49, listen now, and died in 1987, were on the scene at about the same time, one colonized by the French, one colonized by the British, but both of them were studying what black people in America were doing, and both of them also were killed by their homeboys, their brothers, in a coup d'etat And in both instances, Sankara was killed by Blaise Campurari, who he grew up with playing soccer, who was his vice president. Bishop was killed by Bernard Coyd, who was his deputy prime minister in Grenada. This is why it's important what Brother Marvin was doing. And in Durham, North Carolina, same thing we were doing with Howard Fuller and Ben Ruffin, to have these alternative means of education, because it really does a lot, and you can begin to juxtapose what happened with Sankara and what happened with Bishop and what happened with Huey and Bobby, and see similarities in the education. All of the leadership, as I talk about in my book, I have a book out too, Brother Marvin, called Recapturing the African Mind. I'll see to it that you get a copy. But in my book, I talk about the fact that the colonial leadership of Robert Mugabe and Sankara and Bishop and Kwame Nkrumah, they went to colonial schools, but they took that education, turned it around, and used it for the benefit of their people, and began to critically, as Kwame Ture Stokes used to always say, you must critically analyze this material. You can't accept it as it is, but you got to analyze it and look at it for what it's worth. And that's what they did, and that's how they projected themselves into leadership, by taking that knowledge, analyzing it, and using it for the benefit, as Huey would say, using it for the benefit of the masses of the people.
Right. All right. Brother Marvin, let me just stop you 1 minute. We're gonna come right back. This is powerful. I just for the sake of our audience, I want you to know we are talking with Brother Marvin X, out of Oakland, California, and we're talking with Dr. Bruce Bridges from Durham, North Carolina. We're talking about Black leadership.
East Coast to the West Coast.
and we are uncovering some very important facts here. We are talking about quality of leadership for the future. And as anyway, when you're in a conversation this exciting and this powerful, the time begins to fly. We have a lot of our brothers and sisters online now. We have about 35 people on the switchboard. We want to get to some of you, so we need to kind of corral some of this. But one of the things that's extremely interesting that has been brought out is that a lot of times poor leadership is based on poor education and education structures. And that's what we're kind of saying now, because we don't want to lose focus of the leadership part, because I want to, at some point for a few minutes, ask both Dr. Bridges and Brother Marvin about the Gary Convention and what happened in terms of the leadership development that was supposed to come out of that. And so, again, we want to come back to that. You're listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. We're here every Tuesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. We are part of the Time for an Awakening. I'm going to take a quick break, and we're going to come right back. And I want to talk about some of the other programs that are on at the top of this hour, and then get back to, I want to just mention briefly, the Gary Convention, and kind of look at that a little bit, because that's what we did put in our promotion. And then I want to open the lines up to our audience, see what questions that they may have for Brother Marvin and Dr. Bridges, and I'm sure that's going to take us right on into 9 o'clock. So anyway, let's take a quick break, and we'll come right back.
Mr. Carmichael, do you see any change in atmosphere in the South? Do you think that we are approaching a more militant or revolutionary stage in the civil rights movement in the South?
Yes, I certainly think so. I think we're moving now into a political arena. And I think that what Negroes are now tampering in, what they're tampering with, will touch the entire country, to be very precise. For example, many Negroes who have registered to vote have been evicted from their lands in Lowndes County. People who have worked on plantations for 35, 40 years, because they've registered to vote, have been evicted. So that raises a philosophical question, not only for us, but for the whole country. Can property-less people be made as equal as property owners through the vote?
Do you think the formation of your party, the Black Panther Party, is perhaps contributing to the change in atmosphere and making it, in fact, more explosive?
Yes, I certainly think so, because this is the first time in the country that Negroes will be organized for their own political interest, and they will form their own party and move along those interests as they see fit. It is unlike Negroes across the country who are registered in the Democratic Party, but are not organized for their own interests.
Now, what I don't understand is this. You are also a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. At the same time, you are organizing a group in the South, which almost certainly will tend to contribute to violence, or at least counter-violence.
Well, they won't contribute to violence. They will just be seeking their political rights, and they will have to defend those rights. Now, they will defend it the way the country defends its own rights, the way we defend it in Vietnam, the way we defended it in World War II, the way we defended it in World War I, the way they were going to defend it in the Dominican Republic, I imagine. They will defend it the same way.
Well, we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of election, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlines.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
We are back, sisters and brothers. You are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here every Tuesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. here on the timeforanawakening.com network. All of our programs are archived. You can go back at any point in time and listen to anything that has played in the system. You simply go to www.timeforanawakening.com, www.timeforanawakening.com. go into the podcast portal and pull down any of the programs, and you can listen anything that we've aired. I want to also mention a couple of other programs that are part of this network. part of this work. One is on Mondays from 11 to 1 o'clock. There's a program called African Perspectives with my dear brother Oshiemi Adelabu. African Perspectives from 11 to 1 o'clock Eastern Time, broadcasting out of Atlanta, Georgia. And then from 6 to 8 on Mondays, Acres of Diamonds with host Brother Jihad Ahmed. Brother Ahmed has a program called Acres of Diamonds, 6 to 8 p.m. on Mondays here on Time for an Awakening. And then from 8 to 9 on Mondays, Black Therapy Central. Black Therapy Central. The host is Dr. Mawaya Cambone and Sister Nataki Cambone. That program airs on 8 to 9. Had a very dynamic conversation on our Tuesday program. She was interviewed by Sister Bonisha Ayan. Very dynamic conversation. She was the former head of the Association of Black Psychologists. Very proud to have had her as a part of our program. And then from 9 to 10 on Mondays, on the first and third Mondays, every Monday, a conversation on reparations, 9 to 10, every first and third Monday. And then on Tuesday, 8 to 10 Eastern, 7 to 9 Central, Black Reality Think Tank with your host, yours truly. And I want to add, on next Tuesday, we have very, very exciting guest and program. All of our guests are exciting, but we are so honored to have Dr. Raum Nefa Amon. Dr. Nefa Amon is the Shekama, King of Kings of the Orsel Orset Society internationally out of New York City. So we are so proud to have him. He will be our guest next week, and hopefully you will join us. An interesting conversation, I'm sure. And then on Thursdays from 7 to 9, there's a program which is a part of the Black Reality Think Tank family called After 7, a group of young ladies talking about things that are specific to the millennial group, family, children, school, education, and so many ideas. Wonderful conversation that they've had thus far. And then on Fridays from 8 to 10 Eastern Time, Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, who are the managing partners of this network, Time for an Awakening. And very dynamic conversations. They interview some very powerful people. That was where I first heard the interview with Dr. Hare was done by Brother Richard here on this network. And then on Saturdays from 4 p.m. to 6, Black Sister Talk. That is also a part of the Black Reality Think Tank family, Black Sister Talk, dealing, these are psychotherapists who have a clinic where they're working with families on trauma and some of the things that face young people and families in our community. And that's Sister LaWanda Chambers hosts that program. And then from 7 to 9, the program, The Elders of Sankofa, The Elders of Sankofa with Brother Alfonso Watkins, who is also a licensed psychotherapist. He is a dynamic discussion. He had a dynamic psychologist that was on last Saturday, talked about the Bobby Wright syndrome among our community. And then on Sunday, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening again, Brother Richard, Brother Elliot, again, more dynamic conversation, and that's Eastern Time. And then we have a program coming up in August. It hasn't started yet. We're going to be dealing with Black Farmers, the Black Farmers program. And that is really exciting. I'm looking forward to that. So the timeforanawakening.com network is trying to reach out to our community, is providing that platform of information that we need to move forward and develop that leadership that we are talking about tonight. The Black Reality Think Tank Radio Network, we designed this to create a conversation platform that bring all of you together like you are right now on this line and talk about those things that affect the African family globally. This platform, we welcome the discussions of this nature and ideas that proselytize strong agendas that will obviously nurture workable solutions within our community. So thank you, all of you. Thank you. We could not do it without you. We appreciate your support, and we ask that you can continue. Those of you who are listening via Internet, we are a call-in format. If you would like to ask a question or just make a comment, give us a call at area code 215-490-9832. For 215, area code 490-9832. All right. Brother Marvin, wait, do you recall I know you recall it, the Gary convention? Did you attend that convention?
No, sir, brother, but I wanted to say something before I speak on that, if you don't mind.
No, go right ahead.
Because we were talking about leadership and education.
Right.
And we talked about how those of us who were in college were self-educated outside of the college because
right,
there was
exactly.
No black studies. But even more than that, I want to speak about the brothers who were educated in prison.
All right. Amen.
In particular, the brothers out here in the California Department of Corrections that became leaders in the Black Panther Party, and two of them in particular I'm talking about, Eldridge Cleaver and Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. Now, I first met these brothers who were in prison at Soledad Prison in California in 1966. The staff of our magazine, we had a magazine called Black Dialogue, which was in San Francisco, and most of us were students at San Francisco State College that became university. So anyway, we were invited down to Soledad Prison to make a presentation at the Black Culture Club at Soledad Prison, State Prison. So we go down and we enter the room eventually, and the room is organized in military order. You know how it is. You walk in a room and everybody's on post and it ain't no jive and shucking going on.
Right.
And everybody's very, very serious. And Eldridge Cleaver was chairing the meeting and his co-chair was Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. Now, Eldridge was ending up, a lifetime of prison that included about 18 years. So he had done a lot of reading, all kind of literature. Matter of fact, Dr. Hare reminds me that Eldridge Cleaver wrote an article in 1962 in the Negro History Bulletin or something
right. That
Dr. Hare had an article in. So he was writing and reading all during that time he was in prison. So he was well-read. And as I said, when I came into the meeting, he was in the leadership, he and Bunchy Carter. And when we saw the structure of the meeting, and after I heard Eldridge speak, I said, if this Negro get out of here, this is going to be a dangerous Negro, which he proved to be. But my point, my deeper point is this. That meeting, that Black Culture Club, not only was the beginning of the Black prison movement, but also the American prison movement as well.
Mm.
On the Black side, it's known now as Black August, which we are getting ready to celebrate all during the month of August here in Oakland with a festival we're having called BAM Fest, Black Arts Movement Business District Festival. But Black August will be a part of that, and as a matter of fact, I'm going to have a conversation on Zoom with one of the other brothers that was part of the Black Prison Movement. Matter of fact, he's one of the co-founders of Black August, Brother Kumasi, who is like the griot, griot of the prison movement. And I've heard him lecture before, and he can give you a nanosecond by second history of everything that happened in the prison, Black prison movement, from George Jackson on down, Elder Seaver, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So leadership has come, and we know it from Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X,
right,
and others, came out of the prison, were educated in prison.
That's right. That's a powerful one, too. And the Jackson, George Jackson, I understand, was a part
George
of that.
Jackson.
Right.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Exactly. Dr. Bridges, I want to go to the Black Political Convention, but first, do you want to add anything to that prison idea movement in terms of leadership?
No, just wanted to say that Brother Mom is absolutely correct. Anywhere there are people who can get together, and most times not in terms of the Black Studies movement outside the prison, but in the prison, a lot there oftentimes there's very little to be done, and brothers will take that particular time and educate themselves, and we begin to learn and grow and develop. And most of them, and Brother Marvin called a roll, and of course, you know, and he also said, of course, Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad. And not only that, but even when Elijah and Malcolm came out of prison, they would recruit in the prisons more
That's
so
right.
than anywhere else.
That's right.
Because those gangsters would come out, and they were serious, and they had knowledge, and they could really add on to the community because of the discipline that they had developed in the prisons. And that prison life and that prison lifestyle was used to do a lot in terms of moving our people forward in terms of leadership. And there's no doubt Brother Marvin is absolutely right on it when he talks about the prison as being an incubator.
Let me also say this. As far as leadership, let's go all the way back to, I'm not going to say slavery, because a brother out here taught me to say...
enslaved.
we were Africans, enslaved in the American slave system.
Right,
exactly.
But my point is, as far as leadership, if you recall, the African brothers and sisters knew who certain leaders were. And they respected them, even bowed down to them. Am I right?
That's right.
Whether they were spiritual leaders or military leaders or whatever.
They respected
them. So what I'm saying is, your people will recognize your leadership even when you might not even want to. And I'll give you a personal example. When I eventually went to prison behind the Vietnam War for refusing to go to the war, and... when I was at federal prison in Terminal Island in San Pedro, California, and the Muslim brother came up to me. He says, "Brother Marvin, we're gonna have a election today, and you, 'cause you the smartest, you gonna be the minister." He said, "The other brother here, you the secretary, and I'm the captain, and the election is over."
All right.
Now that's how we had election and established leadership in prison.
Yeah, yeah.
You had a choice. The leader didn't have. I didn't have no choice because I wasn't going up against the brother that was talking. Number one.
Right. And you know, I'm probably not going to have enough time to say, but one of the reasons that I wanted to mention the Gary Convention is that when one of our programs on Saturday that came up about why can't we have a national Black political party, and that's why I want to just mention that critically, because very clearly what Brother Marvin talked about and what Dr. Bridges talked about is clear.
Well, let's go there.
Okay, because people recognize powerful leadership. I mean, and I can't say enough about Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey and what he did with UNIA. He was so powerful that Mao Zedong, I mean, not Mao Zedong, the brother from Vietnam recognized
his.
Ho Chi Minh recognized his leadership qualities. But anyway, here's the deal. I went to the Gary Convention. I was there. I was young at the time. I went just with a group of guys from New York. I was living in New York. We wanted to go down and just participate and see what was going on. And I remember Jesse was there, Baraka was there, and a lot of others. And, the brother that was the mayor, was the first time Gary had that. But one of the things that...
Richard Hatcher, Gary, Indiana, right.
Yeah. Right. And so one of the major issues that, and I want to mention, is that... It ended up. It was a powerful meeting. some very good statements, but there were two things that drove a wedge between that gathering that was unable to come out with something strong. Now, there were some things that Baraka and some of the others brought out that were carried on. But one of the things is that they were constantly at each other over the women involvement and how that would look and what needs to happen with that. I know, I remember that being a critical area of discussion and argument. And then the second was it seemed to have been that fraction between East Coast, West Coast ideologies. At that time, it was philosophy. And so I wanted to speak on that because unless we can bridge that kind of stuff, it's going to be, I don't know. I just think it's going to be challenging to put that kind of energy in trying to do that, even though we all say that we need to do something of that energy. So I wanted to talk to the two of you all about it, see what you heard. Brother Marvin, had you heard Baraka talk about that?
You want me to go first?
Now, I want him because I wanted to find out, did Baraka talk to him about the impact of that meeting? And then you can come, Dr. Bridges, with that. Did Baraka ever speak to you in your conversations with him about the Gary Convention?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Please enlighten us.
And basically, from everything that he told me, and everything he did after that, and I feel it's one of the reasons that he turned to Marxism and communism. I feel it was after that Gary convention when he became disillusioned with, what do you call them, elected politicians? Is that the right term?
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. it.
Uh-huh. Elected.
Right.
Elected politicians. And I think he was disappointed after that with the role that they played in these various cities.
Right.
And most especially in Newark when he helped the first black mayor there, Kenneth Gibson.
Kenneth Gibson, that's right.
When Kenneth Gibson got elected, he said Kenneth Gibson sold out to Prudential Insurance before Inauguration Day. So this is how Baraka felt that these politicians were beholden, in many cases, as you know, some Negroes are more loyal to the Democratic Party than they are to black people.
They were.
Exactly.
That's exactly.
And still are. And still are, down to the present moment.
Right.
No doubt about it.
So I'm saying, even though Baraka may have gotten disappointed, he continued to help those politicians who succeeded Kenneth Gibson to become mayor in Newark, and every one of them, up until his son, who's in there now, Ras Baraka, which he hasn't ended, he's not ended, he's just starting his second term. But if you know, all the previous brothers were either indicted and went to jail or prison for corruption.
Right. They sure did.
Right, right. New Jersey.
And then when you look around the country, all the way from the East Coast to the West Coast, you look at Oakland, we had three black mayors in Oakland who did nothing but take care of the corporate entities.
Mm-hmm. And you know,
they did nothing
and
for the hood. Nothing.
And you know, Marvin and Bill, this is what Kwame Stokely used to always tell us. He'd always say, it cannot be, the answer cannot be in politics. Then he would give all the statistics as to how many mayors we have around the country, how many aldermen we have around the country, how many city councilmen we have. He was saying, with all of this political power, but still the masses of the people are in the same condition. And that's what Kwame always said. So he would say that the answer is not in politics. And Bill, I'm going to be quiet because I know you got a lot of people on the phone,
yeah,
man. I want to hear from them.
Right, and I do too. But I wanted to get that out. Thank you so much, right. Brother Marvin. I knew that was what some of that was. And I think at that point, Brother Baraka ended up putting his attention on independent schools and building African-centered educational structures, if I'm correct. And I know that we've got a sister online now who was a byproduct of one of those schools in New York called the East that they built that came out of that Gary Convention. Because they did have a group that met about education and creating African-centered education. And so very much appreciate that. Thanks a lot. Okay, I'm gonna go to the lines. We got, like I said, folks that are on that I know might want to add something. I'm going to start off with a good brother that knows you, Brother Marvin. He said he's out of San Francisco. He said that wonderful city of San Francisco on the hill. And I don't know if he wants to say something or was he just listening. And if he can, he can identify himself if he'd like. But I'm going to open up with my brother from San Francisco, see if there's any questions or remarks that he has to do. How you doing today, my brother?
I'm doing pretty good. My name is Ronaldo Rickett.
Great. Thank you. All right. I didn't want to say it. I knew your name, but I didn't want to say it unless you wanted me to say that.
There's no problem. The FBI knows me very well.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, the FBI know all of us.
Oh, yeah. No doubt about
because
that.
Because you know what? We are in a... All the people are in a Petri dish. And we're in a Petri dish, and we're being studied, you know, by social scientists. And these are the people that created the ghetto. The people that created the ghetto, you know this very well because, you know, the behavior was expected.
Right.
We are predisposed to go to jail because they designed a system for us to fail. And we were designed, it was designed to fail, and we were designed to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, you take the projects, for example. The projects were designed by experiments by this, by the maniac known as B.F. Skinner. I know you're all familiar with B.F. Skinner. And B.F. Skinner designed these experiments.
That's right.
The same way, well, yeah. The projects were designed after an experiment with mice.
Mm-hmm.
They were put in close quarters and with lack of resources. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, bro.
And what happened? Yeah, the projects. And what happened is that they resorted to cannibalism, you know, the stealing of food. You know, and they became violent. They became violent in these close quarters because it was unnatural. We came from an environment that was open. And then we were confined on plantations. And then we were, again, confined in the projects. And what this does, this created a psychosis on the plantation. And what they did is that in this study of mice that was transferred into the project, the behavior, like it's still the same thing is going on today.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Why are people killing each other?
Right.
Why are black people killing each other? And, you know, they're being studied in a Petri dish because, you see, they created the project for it to fail, and the prison industrial complex is based on the experiments they did with mice.
Right. That's exactly right.
Hey, can I say something on this point?
Yes,
Brother,
sir. Go right
Ronaldo.
Ahead.
Please do.
On your point about space, which is what you're talking about, I spoke at University of Virginia, Fayetteville.
Mm-hmm.
And before I spoke, I sat in a graduate class, and the professor was talking about space, and she said 900 Africans were confined to 1 acre of land.
Mm.
Oh, yes.
That's my point.
Mm.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm. Because what happened is that... The mice experiment proved that if you were to confine humans to a minute and confined quarter, what will happen? What will happen is that you will have this robust of energy imploding in the atmosphere because we need space in order to exist. Mm-hmm. And they know if they were to confine our space, is that we will implode and turn on each other. And this is what's going on today.
That's right. That's exactly right.
People in confined quarters are blowing each other away. And they just have, today, they just have guns. They just have guns. And where did they get these guns?
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And this quarantine thing that we're dealing with and some of all of that and then the stress of that is compiled and is creating very strange ways. And I think when next week when Dr. Raum Nefer comes on, I know he does a lot of spiritual work. I want to ask him to speak on that, talk about it from the spiritual realm of things. And
a funny thing about this corona, this COVID-19. My question is, why does it affect Latins and Blacks?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it in Alabama, 90% of the people with COVID-19 are Black people.
Mm-hmm.
In Alabama. This is from the mayor of Alabama.
Mm.
But 90% of the people that it affected.
Mm.
In San Francisco, It's the last.
You know, viruses like Black people. Come on, Ronaldo.
You know what? The point of it I'm trying to make is that there's something they're not telling us about this.
Mm-hmm.
There's something they're not telling us about this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, we're not getting the full story.
It attacks the skin cells. And there's something they're not telling us about it. I know there might be a melanin, there might be a melanin component to this virus,
right,
that they're not telling us. I mean, they didn't tell us about the Tuskegee experiments for 40 years, so maybe 40, 50, 60, 100 years from now, the truth might come out about this virus.
Right, that's right. Okay, thank you, my brother, so much. I appreciate it.
They're not going to tell us everything. When did they tell us about Tuskegee? 40 years later.
Right, right.
When are we going to learn the truth about this virus? We don't know. There are a lot of things that we don't know.
We don't. Okay, I want to go over here to my brother from Montgomery, Alabama, Brother Lush. Brother Lush, what do you got to say about this leadership problem?
Real quick, and then for an essence of time, to Dr. Bridges and to Brother Marvin X, you know, I'm curious to know about leadership and service. You know, today we have a lot of people getting into these different kinds of movement activities and alignments with other kinds and types of groups. But, we've mentioned a lot of ancestors. And one ancestor that stood out to me as you were calling their names was Fred Hampton. And so I'd like to know what kind of service our Black leadership, what Black leadership is providing for their constituents in today's kind of world. I mean, we could talk about the education, but what about the service? What is being done by these Black leaders for the people?
Good question. Excellent question. Bridges,
I can only quote Dr. Julia Hare. We have a lot of leading Blacks and very few Black leaders.
Mm.
Okay. And I think Brother Marvin is absolutely right. There are a lot of leading Blacks, but they're not really leading Black people. And that's one thing when you even read the history of leadership. Leadership really came out of people trying to provide a service for the people. And that's really not what you're seeing today. It's and oftentimes that service does not come in the form of the most charismatic or the best speaker or the one who's on the camera, but it comes from people like Ella Baker that you mentioned earlier. People who really serve the people. And then I'd be remiss not to mention this point before we go off too, in terms of leadership. Our brother, and to tie into it, Brother Marvin, Brother Jamil Alameen, H-Rap Brown, is incarcerated right now. Right now, as we speak, and everything that he stood for and everything that he did while the director of SNCC Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and as he did as a Minister of Defense for the Black Panther Party. People are doing it today, but they don't say anything at all about him. You don't even hear his name. So when I was going to visit him, he said, wherever you go, Brother Bruce, he said, please just mention my name because people have forgotten about me. So to those who are tuned in who don't know, go on your internet and look up Jamil El Amin or H. Rap Brown. H. Rap Brown. And I want to pull that out, H. Rap Brown. Excellent. That should be a rallying cry for many people in today. So that's about all. I'm finished up with that, brother. Right.
But also on the point of leadership, we got a man down in the dungeon in Philadelphia, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Lead the whole damn world from a goddamn jail cell.
Right.
That's right. That's right.
That's exactly right. All right, brother Timothy out of Philadelphia. Nation of Islam? What about brother Jamal? I mean, the brother that brother Marvin was talking about.
Mumia.
Wait, Mumia's dynamite. But I'm gonna stop. We'll come back to Mumia. I'm gonna say this: that some time ago, before the pandemic hit, I happened to be at the Blossom Collection, and brother Marvin X. Last week, it was nice that you had been on the phone last Tuesday because Dr. Bridges was talking about Hawkins Bookstore and Know Thyself Bookstore was several blocks away on 52nd Street. And I had a place to go to because they said somebody by the name of Haki Alabudi was going to be in the Blockson Collection, Donald L. Lee. And he came and he brought his wife. I was introduced to his wife. I didn't know his wife was so scholarly. And we talked, and I ran into a friend of mine, and he said, I talked to you. You told him I said hello. Lamont Steptoe, he talked about you for an hour. He said, y'all had just did a reading. I said, you know, how could he have been here? And I've been on the phone with the brother, okay, through the good doctor who has this program. And I said, I hear so much about it. He said, Tim, that guy read, and we read well together. Now, he's talking about somebody who spent a lot of time with a Mary. Lamont Steptoe. Wonderful. But I'm going to say this about leadership. And I'm going to say this.
I just left a reading with Lamont in Philly back in February.
Just before the
Shakespeare book at the Shakespeare bookstore.
That's right. He told me he was that.
All right.
So listen, I'm going to say this, that we talk about leadership. And being in the nation, I grew up around some powerful brothers in which I was blessed and fortunate to be there. And Sam Christian was the supreme captain under Jeremiah Shabazz. And Jeremiah Shabazz was a man who was very effective, knew economics in Philadelphia. He knew sociology. He knew the teachings. Sam was the supreme captain under Jeremiah. And Sam Christian was not dangerous. He was deadly. You never knew he was coming. Everybody say, nice guy. Nobody to play with. Then you would have, of course, Dr. Lonnie Shabazz, who was in Washington, D.C., who knew the problem book when he came to the Nation of Islam. Mathematician. Taught at Lincoln for a number of years. Okay, you have a person like Muhammad Ali, who you know had all kinds of heart. And Malcolm X, without a doubt. But when we talk about leadership, one thing about the Nation of Islam that we must understand, that we must learn from, that Elijah Muhammad was the embodiment of that strong movement. And once he left, his son came to power and dismantled it. So when we talk about leadership, we need leaders amongst leaders. And now you had Louis Farrakhan, who was able to raise all that back up. Never was like it was before. But my question to you is, if you ever hear his July 4th speech, we hope that he leaves behind a theocratical government. We have leaders amongst leaders because we don't want the one person to be taken away and we're dismantled again. And Brother Marvin X, one day we're going to meet because we always run into people that are always talking about you. It's like I'm going to meet Dr. Bridges one day.
Brother Marvin, I don't know whether that's good or bad.
And you know I'm gonna meet Dr. Rogers one day.
Oh yeah.
I'm gonna meet Sister Benicia one day. You know we all gonna meet. The brotherhood is gonna meet with the sisterhood, and he's gonna take this thing right back over and put it in his right place.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate that, Brother Timothy. Let me go up here to the sister. We haven't heard from my sisters today, and I want to think We don't want to hear. Brother, Sister Benicia, well, you got any comments? Or are you just listening? You want to say something? Sister Yan, would you like to say something? Or are you just listening? Okay, I guess she's just listening. Okay, let me go over to, I know Brother Bridges, you had some people. I know you got somebody here from Rockingham, North Carolina.
Yes, sir. There may be a first timer. Let's see what they got to say. Yeah.
Good afternoon, caller. Would you like to say something? Or are you just listening? 910-206.
Got a lot in the background.
Yeah, so he seems like he's already in a conversation. He's already going on.
Right. Yeah.
Newport News, 757-218. Would you like to say something, caller? You're just listening. Okay, just listening. My brother from New York City, 917-662. How you doing tonight, my brother?
Hey, Dr. Rogers, how you doing? How you doing, Brother Bruce?
Brother Bridges?
Oh, yes, sir.
He spoke with you.
This is Brother Barry.
Oh, Brother Barry, okay. Hotep, my brother, Hotep. I didn't catch your voice there. Okay.
Hotep, yeah. Listen, question for Brother Bruce. Can you speak on anything about Carlos Cook? He was back during the, kept the Garvey movement going.
Right. He really was in the background. You don't hear a lot about Carlos Cook, but right, he really was the foundation for the whole UNIA movement, right? And I think Carlos Cook also had some roots down in the islands, as did Garvey. He came out of Jamaica, I believe.
Yeah, he did.
I know. He came out of the Dominican Republic. He was from the Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead. Talk on that. Okay.
Yeah,
but there's very little all about his. You know, I know he was one of the guys that Malcolm X used to try to meet with, and Malcolm X would ask him, when are we going to speak? And he would tell Malcolm, when you get an agenda. he shied away from the cameras and he didn't like a lot of publicity, you know. But he was, you know, he was one of them revolutionaries. He was fighting the Italians down there at those Black Harlem bars for exploiting Black women, you know. He was real, you know, real strong revolutionary brother, but very little about him.
That's true. That's true. You really don't get a lot. I think I remember reading an article once in the Black Scholar magazine, Brother Chismart, that has that magazine, one of the best magazines that ever existed. But he talked about Carlos Cook. I remember reading an article in there about him.
He said Black Scholar magazine?
Yeah, Black Scholar. Yeah, I love that magazine.
That was Dr. Hare's magazine out here.
Okay, but wasn't Chismart or something, his brother's name was, he was editing it, wasn't he?
Robert Chrisman.
Right. Right, okay.
Robert Chrisman was the editor, yes.
Yep, he was the editor. But Dr. Hare, it was his magazine, correct?
Yeah, he was the founder and the publisher.
Right, exactly. That was a powerful magazine, very powerful.
Yes.
And that type of intellectualism has died now. It's just not there like we used to get it. Like, I even remember, you remember the program that used to come on in New York on ABC, Gil Noble?
Like it is,
powerful. And then the brother out of Howard University that used to do the television show on Saturday evening. Never forget that.
WHUR, right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was great. Okay, Brother Herbie White, how you doing, Brother Herbie?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Good evening, my brother.
Brother Marvin and Brother Brother Bridges, how y'all guys doing?
Great. I'm good a lot.
I just want to make a point on the importance of African leadership.
Okay.
I used to go to, I'd like Brother Bridges to comment on this. I used to go to Bruce's bookstore a lot. And North Carolina Central was less than a half a mile away. But the amount of students that I saw in his bookstore from North Carolina Central, Unicorn School was 200 miles away.
That's true.
Now, I want Brother Bruce to comment on that, because maybe they was there when I wasn't there. I don't want to.
No, I think you saw it for what it was, and it's the same thing that Dr. Rogers was saying earlier. And that is the education that we get inside of the university, not in the courses that Brother Marvin was talking about on the side courses or the peer groups or the little workshops and seminars we had away from class. But what basically goes on a Negro in a Negro institution, which is really another topic we could talk about one night, Bill, that the Negro Negro education in America.
Right.
It's basically a bourgeois education that teaches us and trains us to come out and be effective tools and fools for America, and began to quote them and give their scholarship and their degrees and their references and relate to things as they see it and not even include ourselves. As an example, I had a friend who had a program at NCCU and her program for girls. And the girls would meet in the history department, Bill, at NCCU, where you matriculated. And she said one day she was going to the classroom where her program was being held, and she passed the classroom of a professor. And she said the professor was talking about Marie Antoinette and talking about King Louis the 14th and talking about Prince George and talking about all these Europeans. But at the same time, you would think that he was talking about himself and his people. He had so much zeal and so much enthusiasm in talking about Joan of Arc and in talking about Shakespeare and the Canterbury Tales, that you would think he was talking about himself. And that's where we become deceived. As Bob Marley said, I'm quoting Bob again, which is another thing about education and leadership. When you begin to get true education, you begin to understand that education is not just in the textbooks. You got to listen to the music of Bob Marley. You got to study what the gangsters are doing in the streets. And Elijah Muhammad understood that. All of this is a part of education. So when you understand as Bob says, who you are and where you stand in the struggle, it's okay to teach about European mercantilism and European colonialism and what the British did in China and what they did in India. But you need to understand where you are, as Bob says, and where you stand in the struggle. When we look at 1776, when America became independent from England, you got to understand, black man and black woman, that you were still on the plantations in Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. You may understand that history, but that's not you, you see. And that's what we don't understand, how to divorce ourselves from white America. This is why we use language like our country, our flag, our government.
I know.
You see.
Makes my blood cold.
I want to say this.
And I know you got callers, but I just wanted to mention that. Yeah.
I want to make a point here, brother. I want to say this. What we need to search out is those leaders that were in the background, like Ella Baker and many, many others that you have never heard about.
Right.
That were out here on the West Coast, on the East Coast, and I'll give you a specific example here on the West Coast, right here in the Bay Area, right here at Oakland, who was right there at Merritt College. His name is Khalid Abdullah Tariq El Mansour.
Right.
Otherwise known as Donald Warden, attorney Donald Warden.
But Marvin, let me get in here 1 minute. I'm glad you mentioned him because I brought him to my bookstore, and when Brother Herb mentioned and you mentioned too how all these people come in your BAM, Black Arts Movement, I was doing the same thing. And where is Brother Khalid? I'm glad you mentioned him. I've been asking people.
If you let me finish.
Okay, all right, okay. I heard his very quick.
Okay, let's go back to Donald Warden, who became Khalid Abdullah Tariq El Mansour. So Khalid Abdullah, when I graduated from high school and came to Merritt College in Oakland in 1962, as I said, my fellow students were Huey and Bobby Seal and many other students who were there at Merritt. But we were all, including myself, I wasn't a member of the Afro-American Association, but it was headed by attorney Donald Warden. And this Donald Warden's organization, the Afro-American Association, spread consciousness throughout the Bay Area. And nobody would deny. Huey Newton, if he was alive, would not deny. Bobby Seale would not deny. that they gain much consciousness from being associated with the Afro-American Association. Mm. It led to the establishment of the Black Panther Party. It led to the establishment of Black Studies in the Bay Area, particularly at Merritt College, because the first Black Studies program in the Bay Area was not at San Francisco State. It was at Merritt College in Oakland.
Wow.
The Black Arts Movement in the Bay Area came out of Merritt College, and part of it was from the influence of the of Donald Warden's Afro-American Association. Now, later he became, now this, see how deep this Negro was. Later he became, when he became Khalid Abdullah Tariq Mansour, he had graduated from Howard as a lawyer, but he became a lawyer for OPEC and the Saudi Arabian royal family.
Mm,
he
wow.
became instrumental in getting Obama into Harvard University at the suggestion of the Saudi Arabian royal family. Mm. But let me end with this. Let me end with this. He made his transition a few years ago. He was back on the East Coast. I think he might have been in Kentucky. But I'm asking this question to my people out here in the Bay Area who have not even given him a proper memorial service for all that he did for Black consciousness in the Bay Area.
Mm.
I'll stop with that.
Okay, all right. I want to grab this one call and see if there's a statement. Area code 586-202. You're listening, caller. Would you like to say something?
No, I'd like to share something, if that's okay.
Please, go right ahead.
Okay, listen, Dr. Rogers, that convention in Gary took place in 1972, not 1970. Now, and I'm glad to know that you went there, because at some point later on, I'd like to talk with you more about it.
Okay.
I also want to add that there's a famous film, a documentary about that convention.
Okay.
It's called Nation Time Gary, and it's been revamped and restored. It's the only documentary of that historic event. It was done by a filmmaker named William Greaves, black filmmaker, William Greaves. He's passed on now.
And, is this the owner from Detroit?
It sure is, Brother Marvin. How you doing? Love you.
Detroit in the house.
but Dr. Rogers.
Yes, go right ahead.
In about 30-something days or so, there, you know, that movement for Black Lives, they're having a virtual convention, an online convention,
mm-hmm.
and I was told by a reliable source that they're going to be showing that film, that historic film, called Nation Time Gary.
All right.
Yeah, you know, it includes the folks who were there, speakers like, of course, you know, Jesse Jackson, Richard Hatcher, Amiri Baraka, Charles Diggs, Walter Fontroy, Dick Gregory, Bobby Seale, Betty Shabazz, Coretta Scott King. You know, it's narrated by Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing I wanted to say was I wanted to thank Dr. Bridges for his book, Recapturing the African Mind. I'm not quite done with it yet, although I did purchase it a couple years ago. He mentioned Thomas Sankara and, Burkina Faso. I didn't know if Dr. Bridges knew that back in June at the United Nations, that country,
Burkina Faso.
It tried to start a debate in the United Nations about the racism in the United States. The debate didn't get a lot of legs, but they sure did. They brought it to the floor. They want the UN rights body to debate the systematic U.S. racism in the United States. You know,
right.
African nations plead with them to do that.
Oh, good.
Yeah, Burkina Burkina Faso. Back in my, and Brother Marvin, of course, I definitely want to thank you for the notes to the Artistic Freedom Fighter, your book. I'm so glad that I got a chance to tune in tonight. Thank you for taking
my call. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Appreciate that.
Tune in every week.
All right, let me go quickly to this caller, 331-452. Caller, you have a question or you just listening?
Yes, I do have a question. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
My name is Sipiwe Baleka. I want to shout out to my friend Ricardo Ricketts, who was on earlier. Here's my question. It's a two-part question.
Okay.
One, why has leadership failed to form an effective Black United Front that can serve as the vehicle to represent African Americans domestically and internationally? And the second part of the question is it fair to say that 50 years after the National Convention in Gary, that it is a failure of Black leadership, mm-hmm. that we still don't have a Black United Front?
Brother Marvin, you want to try first? Dr. Bridges, you want to go next?
Well, I mean, we only have to understand that a certain person named Malcolm X, Elhaj Velik El-Shabazz, tried to establish the Organization of Afro-American Unity. And you know what happened to him?
Yes.
So it's no mystery why Blacks are not united into a united front. Because every effort is made to disrupt it, destroy it, and cause chaos within the ranks of any such organization, most likely nip it in the bud. This is the pattern of the neo-colonialists and the globalists or whoever they call themselves.
Exactly.
I call them devils.
Exactly. And this is what Brother Kwame Ture used to always say. It is in the nature and the techniques of the capitalist system to keep the masses of the people divided from the leadership all the way down to the grassroots so they can never get along. And when we look at the division is oftentimes in terms of philosophy. It may be in terms of ethnic background and ethnic color characteristics, education, materialism, and what you may have and own, but there's always something to keep us divided as a people, as a
Dr. Du Bois and Amiri Baraka talked about the Sisyphus syndrome.
Right.
You know the Greek myth of the man who rolled a rock up the hill, and every time he got close to the top, the rock mysteriously was knocked out of his hand, and he had to go back down the hill and start over again.
And that's exactly the same thing that's happening today. This is why I said, Brother Jamil El-Amin, what you see happening in the streets today, as Brother Marvin knows very well, and you know too, Brother William Rogers, that it's not new. It's not new. The riots in the streets, the rebellion, I like to use the word rebellion in the streets. We got to get our language together. There's nothing new, and it's just rehappening again to what was going on in 65, 66, at 6 to 7, but we just don't
The point is, Brother Rogers, who are the real looters? Who are the real looters?
That's right. Brothers and sisters, we've got 1 minute left. Marvin, you want to close with something, and then I'll let Dr. Bridges finish it out. We got 1 minute.
All I'm going to say, Black power matters.
All right. Dr. Bridges?
All right, I'd like to say, quote Marcus Garvey, up you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will.
All right, and with that, I thank you, my brothers and sisters. Next Tuesday, again, Dr. Raoum Nefa Amin will be on from the Osset International Society. We will be discussing some things with him. I really appreciate all of you. Brother Marvin, Dr. Bridges, as always, I appreciate you both. Love you dearly, brothers. Have a wonderful week. I'll see you next week. Take care.
Peace and love to y'all.
Fantastic. Amen. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
This is Ronaldo Ricketts, and it was good to hear about it. It's a good part of
that.
Somebody
told me it would
be like we haven't, Mount Marvin, I haven't seen you since the 50th anniversary of BAM.
Life is a balance.
You lose your grip, you can slip into an abyss. No doubt, you see these niggas tripping. Ego in charge of every move, he's a star. And we can't look away due to the days that he caught our hearts. He's falling apart, but we deny it. Justifying a half-ass shit he dropped, we always buy it. When he tell us he a genius, but it's clearer lately. It's been hard for him to look into the mirror lately. There was a time when this nigga was my hero, maybe. That's the reason why his fall from grace is hard to take. Cause I believed him when he said his shit was pure, ain't he? The type of nigga swear he real, but all around him's fake. The women, the dick riders, you know the yes men. Nobody with the balls to say something to contest them. So he grows out of control. Until the person that he truly was all along is starting to show. Damn, wonder what happened. Maybe it's my fault for idolizing niggas based off the words they be rapping. When come to find out, these niggas don't even write they shit. Here's some new style bubbling up, then they bite this shit. Damn, that's what I get for lying to myself. Well, fuck it, what's more important is he's crying out for help. While the world's egging him on, I'm begging him to stop it. Playing his old shit, knowing he won't top it. False prophets. Somebody should have told me it would be like this. Be like this. Be like this. Somebody should have told me it would be like this. Be like this. False prophets. Somebody should have told me it would be like this. Be like this. Be like this. Somebody should have told me it would be like this. Yeah, false. I got a homie, he a rapper, and he wanna win.